Hello and welcome. Thanks for being here for this webinar this evening. And we've had a few questions submitted that we're going to be answering, but if you have any questions yourself that you would like to ask live or in addition to what we've already had submitted, please type those questions into the Q&A box. So if you hover over the bottom of the screen or tap, if you're on a phone, you should be able to see a Q&A button. And if you tap that button, it pulls up the Q&A box, and that is the appropriate place to type a question. You can type into chat, although chat is not quite as good for questions. So chat is good if we're chatting back and forth in the middle of a question about comments to that question, although Q&A has a place for you to put comments as well. So focus on the Q&A area to type in some questions. And if you want to ask a question live or add input live, then you can let me know that in the Q&A and I can promote you to panelist. And that way you can then be seen and heard if you decide you want to ask a question live. So again, click the Q&A box to ask a question live if you haven't already pre-submitted it. And if you want to come on audio and or video, knowing of course these are recorded, then simply let me know that in the Q&A, or there's a raise hand function where you can raise hand and then I can promote you to panelists, which will allow you to speak to be able to ask a question in that context. So, welcome, and I will begin by diving into a question that we have had submitted. So, I'm going to pull that up and share screen. So, give me just a minute here to do that. In the meanwhile, if you have any questions yourself, go ahead and start to type those into the Q&A box. Okay. So here's the first question we have. And this is about a male age 72 with erectile dysfunction and low testosterone. Also is type 2 diabetic, tires easily, hard to go to sleep, and frequent urination. Suspected body-mind relationship environmental root causes, poor eating and sleeping habits for many years. Prior to retiring, traveled across international time zones, high stress, now retired. Some non-serving diet lifestyle choices and or mindset issues. So classifies himself as a researcher, educated, MDs for Pfizer. How much does stress play a role? Initially a lot. Now that he's retired, salivary cortisol shows normal, total cortisol, with a nighttime value on the high end of normal, DHEA low at 2. Are there mental, emotional, spiritual dynamics at play that you are aware of? Yes, been dishonest, controlling at initial review. Discuss the benefits of Testaplex Plus and some DHEA to raise testosterone. He was getting injections of testosterone, which he had initially failed to inform. And this person explained he didn't want to do the supplemental regimen if he was doing testosterone injections. He said, okay, he was stopping them anyway, but on the second visit found out he was still doing injections and the doctor administering them said it was okay to take whatever to give additional support in addition to the injections, became agitated later, discussing labs, waiting to get labs from him and his doctor to see what his testosterone is before proceeding with that. In the meantime, interested in helping with other factors of erectile dysfunction, but have very little experience. And because he's a researcher, would like to have some research to offer him for sake of compliance going forward. And then no MMCP program recommends pycnogenol and L-lysine along with L-arginine to potentiate nitric oxide and blood flow to the peripheral. So wants to know about nitric oxide supplementation and how to do it safely, looking for particular products and beneficial dosing. So other patient information, history, obstacles to treatment, things that are going well. 4 weeks of dietary transition leading to elimination diet and detox for subsequent 4 weeks. Energy and weight improving some, great. Erectile dysfunction still present. He is on blood pressure and diabetic meds, have educated that to get to the root of erectile dysfunction, we have to get diabetes under control. He also took himself off diabetes and blood pressure meds in the first 4 weeks. He was monitoring both and feeling better. Did not do so under doctor supervision. Then after, as had been agreed upon, then after a visit, his doctor was told no reduction of diabetes meds until the A1C went down and we didn't test A1C yet. Blood pressure was cut in half 6 of the 7 days. Fantastic. And did initial labs. Okay. So what we've got here is someone who's 72 years old with erectile dysfunction as the chief complaint and low testosterone. Now, at 72 years old, of course, this is going to be, you know, very common for there to be a difficulty with erectile dysfunction and low testosterone. And the type 2 diabetes, of course, one of the big side effects from or complications of diabetes is erectile dysfunction. So, and frequent urination. So we can already see a connection between his chief complaint and urinary frequency with the diabetes. So you're on the right track with, Christina, you're on the right track with looking at the diabetes, looking at diet, making that a primary focus. That's a really great thing to be doing. Now, poor eating and sleeping habits for many years are likely to have created a circadian rhythm dysfunction. So we're going to want to address circadian rhythm with some lifestyle in addition to the diet and supplements. So we'll talk through some of that lifestyle as well. And what I'm going to do here actually is I'm going to switch the screen share to a document so that we can create some notes here on a protocol. Okay, so we have male, 72 years old, and we have CC, chief complaint of erectile dysfunction, and low testosterone. Additional symptoms of tires easily, difficulty going to sleep. And that's important that we know that it's going to sleep versus staying asleep. Christina, if you can type into the chat or the Q&A, if you know for a fact whether it's just difficulty going to sleep or if he also has trouble staying asleep throughout the night and or if he wakes early or has difficulty waking or is tired on waking, that'll help with the lifestyle piece on circadian rhythm. So type that in if you're able. And then frequent urination. So, currently retired, which is important because that's going to help with lifestyle suggestions. Currently on. So he wakes to urinate several times at night. Okay. And currently on testosterone injections, taking diabetes medication. And do you happen to know if that's metformin or insulin or both or another drug? That would be helpful as well. And blood pressure medication. So note on urination, blood pressure medication often involves diuretics, and those increase urinary frequency. Also, the diabetes can contribute. Also, a question about whether T injections may be raising DHT and contributing to a prostate issue. So we have a few things here with relation to the frequency in urination, the difficulty with sleeping through the night because of waking due to that frequency of urination. We have some complicating factors. So the blood pressure medication involving diuretics, which I'm guessing it might. We don't know for sure which ones he's on here unless you are able to type that in. But that, of course, is going to increase urinary frequency, which is going to disrupt sleep, which is going to worsen fatigue. And worsened fatigue and interrupted sleep has been shown to increase the next day insulin resistance and contribute to blood sugar dysregulation. So we have a bit of a cycle here that's going to be problematic, which means if we're going to disrupt the cycle and get to the root, we want to address the blood pressure and work towards getting off of BP meds. So in order to work on the blood pressure, I'm going to start there. We're going to then, what I'm doing here is I'm talking through here as I'm thinking so that you can see how I'm thinking about this case. And I'm going to go over a lot of details and then I'm going to circle it back to a bigger picture. And this is often what I'll do with clients is when they come in, I'll talk through a lot of detailed things on the different labs that they bring in or that we have ordered. And then I'll go back and I'll go big picture and I'll say, okay, here are the most significant leverage points that we're going to start to address and put together a protocol that's a manageable number of things for that person. So for blood pressure, one often overlooked variable is low potassium. On a CMP, a comprehensive metabolic panel, or an electrolyte panel, we would like to see potassium 4.5 to 5.0. Now, that's not a perfect functional indicator of potassium status in the cells because that's in the blood. The body regulates in the blood a little better than in the cells. But because he's diabetic and because there's probably an increased cardiovascular disease risk because of one, his age, two, diabetic, and three, poor diet and lifestyle for a significant period of his life, we want to minimize cardiovascular disease risk in addition to helping the blood pressure, which in and of itself will lower cardiovascular disease risk. And the lowest cardiovascular disease risk is seen with a serum potassium between 4.5 to 5. And many times I see serum potassiums at 4.2, 3.5. So this is an easy lab to get a hold of, super easy to get a CMP. It's usually ordered anyway by most doctors. So you may already have ordered it, or another doctor the person's seeing may already have ordered it. So on a CMP, we'd like to see that potassium 4.5 to 5, and not or, because potassium in the serum could be normal without cellular levels being normal. We also want to make sure that dietary potassium intake exceeds the RDA of 4,700 milligrams per day. 4,700 milligrams per day, or 4.7 grams of potassium, is a significant amount. It can be done through diet alone if a person eats a lot of leafy greens, starchy tubers, and an assortment of fruits and vegetables and avocados. So one of the biggest sources of potassium in the diet is potatoes, white more than sweet potatoes. Avocados are also a significant source. Plantains and bananas. Bananas are famous for potassium. Plantains have a lot too, and bananas actually don't have as much as potatoes. So starchy tubers are often even more, so are avocados. And then leafy greens. Okay, so his potassium was 4.0 initially. So for leafy greens, I usually recommend a variety at 3 to 5 cups per day is a nice place to be for an amount of leafy greens. And so you can have, you can encourage some things like baked potatoes or cooked and cooled potatoes if you want resistant starch as well. You can encourage sweet potatoes. You can encourage a variety of leafy greens. You can encourage pinto beans have a lot as well. If you're doing beans for a person, you may be doing a paleo diet or things that would exclude beans temporarily. Some meat like salmon, turkey has some potassium, but with meat, you are going to have a decrease in that potassium as the moisture content of that meat decreases. So for meat, preserving the moisture, as in stews where you're consuming the liquid that the meat is cooked in, or by cooking in a method where you're not going to deplete so much of the juices, and those juices are going to evaporate. And salmon would be a good source. So salmon is a good source. You just want to cook it in a way that would minimize the moisture loss. So you might cook it covered instead of uncovered, so that less moisture evaporates if it's being pan seared, for example. You might even add a little liquid and then make sure to consume the liquid that it's cooked in. And that would be a way to get potassium from a dietary source. So you can use a tool like MyFitnessPal or another tracking method for a few days to see how much potassium is being consumed. Or you can focus on high potassium foods each day to ensure a good base on top of the variety of meats, veggies, fruits a person is having. So that would be something to consider. But in the context of a diabetic, we want to, if we use potatoes, cook, then cool 24 hours, and have cool or at room temperature to reduce the, or to make the starch more resistant, and to increase the, or to decrease the blood sugar spike. So the blood sugar spike from potatoes will be less if those potatoes are cooked then cooled 24 hours to make that starch resistant. Plus then that resistant starch will also help feed healthful bacteria in the intestines. So that's a strategy to help to reduce the blood sugar impact of that food as because we're dealing with someone with diabetes. The other thing to do is for bananas, be sure they are green and not ripe, again to make starch more resistant and reduce blood sugar impact. So those are going to be important pieces to do for blood pressure to see if potassium deficiency may be part of why the blood pressure has been elevated. Now, what you're doing, Christina, already is working because you said 6 out of 7 days his blood pressure was cut in half, which is amazing. So keep doing what you're doing, and you might add potassium in if that's not quite enough to be able to lower or eliminate the blood pressure medication. Also, hibiscus tea can be helpful, and that's for regulating blood pressure as well. Loose leaf tea made into a gallon at a time is often great for having a few days worth refrigerated and ready to go. So you can make loose leaf tea into a gallon of tea, refrigerate that tea, and then drink 3 to 4 cups per day, and that can help with blood pressure as well. Now, nitric oxide here, helping with nitric oxide can also help blood pressure and erectile dysfunction together. So we have both being able to be helped with one target intervention, the target intervention being nitric oxide. So if we want to address nitric oxide, then we can do that for his chief complaint, but get a side benefit of some improved blood pressure because of the vasodilative mechanism. So what we're going to want to look at in this case for nitric oxide production is in particular arginine. And arginine can cause diarrhea in some cases. So that's just a, you know, you had asked for when working on nitric oxide, how do you do it safely and what are some of the side effect potentials or profiles? So for L-arginine, it can cause diarrhea in some cases. 6 grams per day is a good target dose, starting with 3 grams per day and slowly working up as long as diarrhea is not present is going to be a way to help to minimize that side effect. So L-arginine at 3 grams per day in the beginning, gradually working up towards 6 grams per day would be helpful. There is a relationship between L-arginine and L-lysine. So the amino acids have pairs, and these pairs work in balance with each other. So when we're working on L-arginine and increasing L-arginine, in some cases, L-lysine in relation to how much arginine there is can be a bit lower. And that could be an issue in rare cases of chronic viral infections. I haven't seen any evidence in this case of a chronic viral infection, so I'm not concerned about lysine in this case in proportion to arginine, and I would simply add the arginine and not worry too much about the lysine. So unless there's some evidence of that I'm not aware of a dysfunction from a chronic viral infection. Then there's the potential, there are some other things that can help with nitric oxide in addition to arginine. And one thing I'll put here, high caffeine intake together with arginine can worsen the chance for diarrhea. So that's just another FYI. So arginine is probably the number one in terms of nitric oxide improvements, but there's a couple of things that can also be helpful. So there's, interestingly, glutathione can slow down the breakdown of nitric oxide. So while it's not researched itself to increase directly nitric oxide, it is used physiologically in the body to slow the breakdown of nitric oxide, meaning that the nitric oxide that a person has can last a little longer. So that could be helpful in this case to add some glutathione. So at least 200 milligrams per day could do up to 1 gram per day. Now that's going to depend on form. So if you're using, for example, S-acetyl glutathione at 200 milligrams per day would be one option. Oral reduced glutathione at 500 to 1,000 milligrams per day. Liposomal glutathione at 200 milligrams per day. So the more absorbable forms, liposomal or S-acetyl glutathione, should be fine at 200 milligrams per day. If you're using a reduced glutathione oral, I would start at 500 to 1,000 milligrams per day, and that would be something to help with the chief issue of nitric oxide, glutathione also helps reduce general oxidation, which is more of an issue with diabetes, so that's important to do. And then there's things like, you know, I would say that agmatine and citrulline are options, but not as high a priority in this case. So really we're looking at L-arginine being a significant player for what we're looking to do in this case for nitric oxide, for the erectile dysfunction. The things we're looking for in terms of doing it safely is making sure that we're not inducing diarrhea. And by starting at 3 grams per day and working up slowly, we're less likely to induce diarrhea. Also, making sure that we don't see signs of chronic viral infection would be helpful as well. So that's on the nitric oxide side, which will help both blood pressure and ED, erectile dysfunction. So because ED is the chief complaint, we want to, of course, address significantly. We already talked about NO, and that is the main intervention. And then we want to also look at pycnogenol, and pycnogenol is, so there's pycnogenol and there's grape seed extract, and I'd like to describe to y'all a little bit about the difference between the two. So pycnogenol is, and usually it comes from pine bark, and pycnogenol has a lot of research. For someone like him who's really into research, pycnogenol may be helpful because it has a little more research. What I'm going to say is that grape seed extract, and I'm going to make sure to say not grape fruit seed extract, just because sometimes those two get confused, is a great antioxidant and also has similar constituent profile as pycnogenol. So if someone is really wanting exactly what's been used in research, then pycnogenol would be a good choice. If someone doesn't mind so much what's exactly used in research, but they want the constituent that's used in research, sometimes grape seed extract is an acceptable alternative, and it's a little more affordable. There's a couple of ways to go in terms of the pycnogenol and the research on pycnogenol and ED. So so you can go with straight pycnogenol, or you can add L-lysine to it as well. And part of the way pycnogenol is working is through nitric oxide and the boosting of nitric oxide. So it is working in a similar way, although the studies are different. So there's some studies on pycnogenol, some studies on L-arginine, some studies on pycnogenol and L-arginine. So there's some differences in those studies and how much is used, but 2 40-milligram doses of pycnogenol is one study that's commonly used. So we'll add 40 milligrams twice per day as a good option for a study dose on pycnogenol, and that can be together with the 3 to 6 grams of L-arginine. Now, one study used 1.7 grams L-arginine with 240 milligram doses of pycnogenol, and that did well, although some studies went as high as 120 milligrams of arginine, of pycnogenol, so 3 doses per day, and 3 grams per day of L-arginine. And there were very few side effects, and the higher doses were associated with 70 to 90% of men having restored erections with no side effects. So that's pretty good in terms of results there. So a 2007 study found 180 milligrams of pycnogenol increased arterial expansion by 42% in young healthy males, and those males were actually given an inhibitor of L-arginine. So pycnogenol was working in a different way than L-arginine, which is why we're wanting to use the two together. And pycnogenol was also shown in other studies to reduce inflammation. So it can inhibit some of the COX enzymes 1 and 2, and that can help with inflammatory reasons for difficulty with erections or other health problems. And then, so basically the dose ranges in pycnogenol go all the way up to 200, but we're going to see peak benefit from probably 120 milligrams, maybe even 80 milligrams. So you can range it up to 200 milligrams, but probably it's most cost effective to dose it closer to the 40 milligrams 2 to 4 times per day on pycnogenol. Alternative to pycnogenol would be grape seed extract at 250 milligrams twice per day would be a great dose on that. So you could do that. And one interesting option for supplements is, you know, we're talking here about mostly just the constituents that have been researched, especially since this person is big into research. But I'll mention that in terms of, you know, a particular supplement, there is an interesting supplement by Zymogen called VitalVasc, and VitalVasc combines grapeseed extract together with olive extract and a citrus sinensis extract called CordyArt. And so another idea is VitalVasc, probably some benefits similar to pycnogenol from the grape seed extract in there, and also has CordyArt and olive extract can help with blood pressure. It was designed for blood pressure, may also help with erectile dysfunction because of the way that it's designed for both antioxidant activity and nitric oxide synthesis. So that's another one that would be interesting to consider in this case. Now, when considering testosterone, regardless of injections, there are a few things that we can do that aren't necessarily looking at boosting testosterone directly, but are looking at doing some things that are going to help to preserve the testosterone in the body and are going to help with some of the other factors involved with the way that testosterone gets processed in the body. So things to consider are aromatase inhibitor substances, and some men who are given testosterone injections are already given aromatase inhibitor drugs. So you want to see if he's already given an aromatase inhibitor drug, but aromatase enzyme converts testosterone into estrogen. And when aromatase is elevated, which it often becomes elevated in men who are going through middle age and beyond, and especially when there's insulin resistance, especially when there are blood sugar dysfunctions, aromatase is interrupted, and that's part of the reason for testosterone becoming low, especially if estrogen is going high. So if when a man comes in with a lab where testosterone's declining and estrogen is climbing, that's a case where aromatase inhibition is important and one of the primary interventions to not directly try to change testosterone levels, but to stop testosterone from converting to estrogen, which indirectly then will allow for testosterone levels to increase. So aromatase inhibition is helpful and utilized clinically together with testosterone injections in conventional medicine. So natural aromatase inhibition should be of benefit to help with preventing that testosterone from increasing estrogen, and the extra testosterone increasing more estrogen could lead to estrogenic effects that would be undesirable for a man. So we want to look at aromatase inhibiting substances, and one of the lifestyle things is decreasing alcohol intake, because alcohol is an aromatase promoter and we want to reduce aromatase or inhibit aromatase. So decreasing alcohol intake is going to be a key lifestyle suggestion in this case, and something that we really want to ask if he's consuming alcohol, and if so, how regular a basis. Alcohol is also going to be a hidden source of caloric intake and a spike to blood sugar that people often ignore. So people will often have alcoholic beverages that have some sugar in them, like wines or like mixed drinks that add sugar to them, or beers that have calories. So usually if something is hard alcohol, there's less of a caloric and blood sugar impact, but there's still the aromatase promotion activity from the alcohol itself. So that's something to consider in this case, is to really advise strongly about elimination of alcohol during therapeutic intervention. So see if he's willing to go on hiatus from alcohol and make sure that that is realistically doable for him. And if it's not, then negotiate and try to find a level of alcohol intake that's reduced significantly, and potentially see if you can minimize the blood sugar impact of alcohol that's being had by choosing hard alcohols mixed with things like bubble water and lime zero sugar additives, and also capping it at a point and drinking lots of water, and maybe taking extra glutathione for helping to replete glutathione that can get depleted with alcohol consumption. So that would be one. Now, you can also look at other aromatase inhibiting substances and or supplements and that would be an option as well. I wouldn't go too deep into that because in this case with diabetes, there's a lot of lifestyle stuff that we can do. But I think that decreasing alcohol intake is for sure a very significant thing to do. And we could look at some forms of aromatase inhibition, depending on how significantly the person is interested in that and how much we're really wanting to give them in terms of supplementation. But that is something worth considering and getting a, you know, a reasonable sense for. So for aromatase inhibition, think through a little bit about whether, you know, whether to do that beyond the alcohol reduction, but for sure look at the alcohol reduction as a piece of it. And then other things that can be helpful in erectile dysfunction are acetylcholine. So I would make sure that choline is adequate, and there are different forms of choline and dietary sources of choline and ways to supplement with choline. And so that's a whole topic in and of itself that I'll dive a little bit into and do a little bit on. And then saffron, tongkat ali, panax, ginseng, carnitine, and folate all have varying nitric oxide effects. So you're going to potentially get a little benefit from those. The way tongkat ali is working is tongkat ali is helping to reduce the binding of testosterone, meaning more free testosterone, less affinity from sex hormone binding globulin to bind to testosterone. In this case, I'm not going to emphasize that because of the testosterone injections at this point. It may not be needed or, you know, very helpful necessarily, but that's something to, if he does go off of testosterone injections, to consider. And then flash arrest would be an aromatase inhibitor on the supplement side. That you could use, and that's by Zymogen. So that's one option if you were to want to use an aromatase inhibiting supplement. Regardless of injections, also vitamin D status is important, and 35 to 60 is a good functional range. If you add parathyroid hormone, you will want to see PTH less than 30. So the range usually goes from 15 up to 60 or 65, depending on the lab. You want to see it in the 15 to 30 range for PTH. And if PTH starts to rise above 30, that may be indicative of vitamin D and or calcium deficiency. So if PTH is in the 15 to 30 range and vitamin D is down near 35, that's not a problem. I wouldn't necessarily think that there would be a need for additional vitamin D because parathyroid's really saying, hey, we're good on the vitamin D here, but I would just make sure that there's some sunlight, natural sunlight for overall vitamin D production. Interestingly, potassium can increase the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis and testosterone levels. So potassium is one to consider for being able to have testosterone levels optimized as well. So potassium status for multiple reasons here. And I always really like to think about things that are good for multiple different reasons. So something that's helpful because of blood pressure being high, and that's also helpful in relation to testosterone and or erectile dysfunction, we want to layer on the things that are going to be most helpful. In addition to diet, if it is hard to get enough potassium from diet, you can supplement potassium citrate powder is my preferred form of potassium. You're going to see there is some info out there about 99 milligrams as a cap on oral potassium intake. This is based on research on IV and not oral. There is no actual restriction on oral dosing of potassium. And as far as safety is concerned, this is up to you and your own risk tolerance and litigation. So you have to choose for yourself what you want to do with potassium. But I feel confident based on the research that I've seen personally to use doses of potassium up to 3 grams per day based on RDA values plus the evidence from hunter-gatherer cultures and how much they consumed, plus the clarifications about the problems with potassium supplementation being only IV and those IV doses causing very quick spikes in potassium levels that can lead to heart rhythm changes and heart issues. But that is not the case, as far as I can tell from research, on supplemental potassium. So up to 3,000 milligrams per day, supplemental oral potassium citrate, you know, I'm going to say in my opinion, so don't take this as, legal advice. I have no idea about that. But in my opinion, professionally, based on research, is okay to do. And you can do it in divided doses together with meals. And I think that's pretty important to do divided doses together with meals. So you could do, for example, 1 gram potassium citrate per meal for 3 meals mixed with food or mixed with glycine in water and consumed gradually throughout the meal, because that's going to be mimicking the closest to food potassium. Now, I will say potassium citrate has a very strong taste and is not so pleasant to consume, which is part of why I said mixed with glycine in water. And I'll say mixed with about 3 grams or 1 teaspoon glycine in water, because glycine will offset the potassium taste. Glycine is sweet. And glycine, in his case, for this patient, is also going to reduce blood sugar. And so even though it's sweet in its taste, it reduces blood sugar. So I'm going to go down here and just have an overall supplement recommendation. And here I'm going to put possibly, so I'm going to say possibly, and the possibly depends on how much he wants to do with diet around potassium and how much we're going to need to do from supplements. So potassium citrate powder, 1 gram with glycine, 3 grams mixed in water and consumed with meals. I'm going to say gradually throughout meals, TID, so three times per day. So that is one, I think, very strong candidate for an intervention to do here to help with blood pressure and testosterone and to help with blood sugar as well. Whenever we're supplementing with potassium or increasing potassium significantly in the diet, magnesium is a good thing to increase and to address as well. And we could do a variety of forms of magnesium. I'm going to say glycinate because the glycine, again, we have reason for glycine for blood sugar regulation purposes. So I'm going to say magnesium glycinate at 400 milligrams per day. That could be all at once or in divided doses. That would depend on his bowel habits. If he were struggling with constipation, I'd do that all in one dose with the evening meal to work to stimulate smooth muscle for a morning bowel movement. So that is one option for magnesium. If constipation is not an issue, I'd do it in two divided doses with meals. So that would be 200 milligrams twice per day with meals. Okay, initially was low in magnesium, had him on OptiMag 125, 4 per day, fantastic, that's perfect. So 4 per day is fine, you know, it could be 400 to 600 per day, so being in that 125 at 4 per day, you're at 500 milligrams per day, that's fantastic, so that'll work great. And it doesn't have to be glycinate, OptiMag is just fine. Then we're going to want to add the L-arginine, starting at 3 grams daily. Now, for L-arginine timing of dosing, there's some evidence that if he's working out, which he should be if he's trying to increase testosterone, so weightlifting, high-intensity interval training, of course, in a safe way at 72, he needs to be safe about it, but to do that in a safe way would be significant in terms of being able to boost testosterone and for overall health impacts for insulin sensitivity and for diabetes. So there are lots and lots and lots of reasons to do high intensity interval training and or weightlifting. And so one option is to half an hour before exercise, take the nitric oxide boosters on days where he is exercising. On days not exercising, can be after meals. I say after meals because as an amino acid, we might digest a little more of that towards the end of a meal after other amino acids have, rather than competing all the amino acids together, you might metabolize just a little bit more, but it's not a big deal. Sometimes it's way easier for people to just take everything with a meal. So it's fine to take it with a meal just for compliance sake, if compliance will be an issue. But if he's someone who wants to maximize everything and tweak, hone, and refine, a little bit after a meal, maybe 20, 30 minutes or so, the stomach would be cleared of a lot of the other stuff and the absorption may be a little bit better. Gradually work up to 6 grams per day over several days if no diarrhea on that. Pycnogenol or grapeseed extract. So we're going to just say pycnogenol, 40 milligrams, three times a day is a pretty reasonable place to see if he's open to doing that. And that would be with meals is fine. If he wants to do twice a day dosing, you could do two with one meal, one with another meal, because some people often will do better with twice a day dosing versus three times a day dosing, just because, again, of compliance. And sometimes in the middle of the day, it's harder to take something, but he's retired. So I'm going to assume that it's okay to do three times a day dosing since, you know, he's retired, but ask him, because we want to make sure that he is able to do more frequent dosing. And so I'm going to say pycnogenol here, and I'm going to put in parentheses, could also do vital vasc at two caps once daily or one cap. I'm going to say one cap twice daily, divide it, and reduce pycnogenol by one per day. So you could do twice a day pycnogenol and one cap twice a day vital vasc as an alternative to help maybe a little more on a combo of the blood pressure and the nitric oxide in this case. So then I would consider berberine for blood sugar regulation and also addressing any gut issue. So I didn't see any, it sounds like labs are ordered, but maybe they aren't back in, so we don't know what gut issues might be present, but I'd recommend a small intestinal bacterial overgrowth breath test and or a stool sample in this case to see what we've got going on in the gut, because we often see a relationship between gut issues and blood sugar dysfunction and blood pressure issues and cardiovascular disease risk. So for a host and variety of reasons, I think it's important and helpful to have some gut testing in this case, but we could warrant a berberine supplement regardless of gut issues because of the blood sugar issue. And with taking berberine, we are going to want to monitor blood sugar levels and have him get a hemoglobin A1C so that there can be modifications in his dose on metformin or whatever blood sugar medication that he's on, and him, of course, monitoring his own blood sugar levels so that if it does drop low, that he can begin to help to get that medication dialed in. So he is on it. He is on berberine. Did the GI urinary, I'm not sure what that is, if you can elaborate on that. SED test showed lower absorption. Oh, the urinary indican test. So organic acids dysbiosis, indican bacterial marker, normal. So not a marker on a urinary dysbiosis test. Okay, great. So that's good. I wouldn't give up there. I wouldn't, you know, stop at a GI urinary test if there's budget for enough more other labs, or he's willing or ready to do other labs. I would add a SIBO test. I would add a SIBO breath test and or a stool test. SIBO breath test, you know, would be number one. Stool test would be number two. And for stool tests, a GI map would be a great one, or, you know, depending on what lab you use, but a GI map or 401H GI map by Diagnostic Solutions Lab, or 401H by BioHealth, or CDSA with Parasitology Times 3 by Doctors Data, or Dunwoody, or a GIFX by Genova. All of those are good stool tests. So that would be secondary to a SIBO breath test. I think the SIBO breath test is a little more likely to come up positive, but both of those would be valuable tests, and the SIBO breath test is also more affordable. So that would be something to
consider, but Berberine is good regardless, and it looks like he's on it, so that's great. Then the other things that can be helpful, of course, in blood sugar dysregulation are going to be low carbohydrate diets, and it sounds like there's some dietary intervention and detox stuff going on already, so I'm not going to go over that too much other than to say that doing something like a ketogenic diet or an autoimmune paleo protocol or a low-carb paleo would all be reasonable options depending on his personal preferences, what other markers might have come up, any other conditions, if there are any. That would all play into choosing a dietary plan and approach, so that would be important. Now, let's go on to... Let's see. So I want to talk through the lifestyle stuff on sleep. You know, I think the frequent urination, it's going to be helped by taking care of the blood pressure and reducing those medications, helping with the blood sugar and reducing the diabetic side of things, and blood sugar will help as well. So I think we're off to a good start on the frequent urination piece. So I want to talk through lifestyle and difficulty going to sleep. I think the erectile dysfunction, we've already got a good start on with the nitric oxide supplementation, the low testosterone. It's a mixed bag because he's getting the injection, but we have a couple things we can do. And sleep's important for the blood sugar as well. So sleep, we're going to be doing sleep hygiene suggestions. And you're probably aware of these if you've gone through the HPA module. If you haven't yet, then, you know, you'll get to them in a lot of detail. And you can always look in the quick treatment guides on circadian rhythm issues. But the big heavy hitters, I'll just, you know, briefly overview. I would be, you know, really restricting blue and bright lights at night. I would do zero electronics 2 hours before bed if he is willing. And I would get red lights and or LED candles and or blue blocking glasses like UVX amber glasses or Swanee's blue blocking glasses. Those are both good ones that block a very, very high percentage. The Swanee's are more stylish, so if there's concern around being around other people at all, use the Swanee's. They're going to be more stylish. If there's no concern about that, the UVX are effective and less expensive. Both are available on Amazon, and I would use the glasses at least 2 hours before bed if there is any blue or bright light exposure, particularly blue light exposure, because that's the purpose of the glasses, is to reduce the blue light spectrum, not so much to reduce brightness. So I'll just say blue light exposure. So if someone's going out with friends, if they're gonna watch electronics anyway, even though you're advising not to, wear the glasses for at least that 2 hours before bed. Red lights, what we do in our home is we have some switches, light switches, that are for bright and blue lights, and some light switches that have red LED lights. And those are the lights that we use at night. These days, they make light bulbs, LED light bulbs that you can switch. You can turn them red or white or blue or purple or green or rotating between them, all sorts of stuff. They're pretty wild. And those lights are great because then some of them you have an app on your phone and you can set it to turn red. You can, some of them have a remote and you can push a button and they turn red. And then you can have the same light switch. It can be a day night, a daylight and a night light, both. Now, depending on how extreme you want to go with this, I even changed the light in our fridge at home to be a red light because research shows that even as little as 1 minute of blue light exposure can interfere with melatonin production. So bathrooms and refrigerators are big sources of blue light that a lot of people don't think about. So either wearing the Swanies or UVX when opening the fridge or going to the bathroom, or having some LED candles that go in the bathroom, or a light switch that has red lights, or being able to change the bulb in the refrigerator to a red bulb, all are reasonable options for being able to minimize that blue light exposure at night. Also, bright lights are important to reduce, so put all lights at night lowest on the dimmer setting and use less lights if possible while being safe. So there's a lot of stuff around, obviously I don't want to trip on stuff, especially at the age of 72, that would not be good, but we do, there is an adjustment period where it takes a person a while to get used to that low light, red light situation. So it takes a minute, but it is well worth that adjustment in terms of the sleep hygiene impacts and the melatonin internal production impacts. F.Lux is an app for Mac and PC if computer is being used. Of course, the recommendation ideally is don't use computer, but if you do, use F.Lux to reduce it. iPhone has Night Shift, but that is only partly helpful. It is not fully helpful. So what I recommend in addition to Night Shift is to also go into settings, so set night shift for the maximal blue reduction. So night shift is in settings, display and brightness. And then you can set it from sunset to sunrise. And fully move the bar to the more warm side. So that's helpful, but it's not enough. It's only partly helpful, and it doesn't reduce the blue light or the brightness enough. So the way to get the phone, especially if the phone's used at night, to be fully bright is a little backwards. So on the, you know, it's not super easy to do. So I'm gonna see if I can find it here. So you go into settings, general, and then accessibility. And those of you who are watching who have an iPhone, I'd recommend just going along with this and doing this because it'll help you in your own melatonin preservation at night as well. And, you know, a lot of people end up, for whatever reason, even if you intend not to, checking your phone from time to time at night. So this can be a helpful tool for you. It's not completely automated. You have to push a shortcut on your phone instead of having it automate the process. I liked it when you used to be able to have Flux on the phone, but App Store doesn't allow that at this point. So this is the best option that I found at this point on an iPhone. On other phones, on Android, I think you can get Flux as an app, which is great, but for iPhone, here's the best solution. So settings, general, accessibility, display accommodations, and then color filters. And you want to turn that on and change to fully red, or as fully red as you can tolerate and still see things enough to get by. So you want to turn that color filter on and do the color tint as red as possible. So one way to do that, so you can check color tint and slide intensity all the way to the right and hue all the way to the left. And that's going to be very red. Then what you want to do is, you can then, once it's set to red, you can turn it back off, and then what you want to do is create a shortcut to that color filter. So then in general accessibility, then go to settings, general accessibility, and you want to go to, at the very bottom, accessibility shortcut. And when you tap there, you want to check the box for color filters. Under triple click the home button for. Now, when you triple click the home button, it should turn your phone red. So try it out. And then to turn it back to normal, triple click the home button again. Now, there comes the training process of actually doing that. In the evening, you can create a voice command for that if you want to, and you could have it be, you know, like a voice command where you could say night, or you could say red, or you could do it as a voice command with Shortcuts app. And the Shortcuts app lets you create voice commands, or you can just do that triple click shortcut. And you just have to get in the habit of triple clicking after sunset when using the phone. So So that's the hardest part, is getting in the habit of it, because it's not completely automated. If anyone knows of a way to completely automate that and start that at sunset, please let me know. Otherwise, this is the best solution I've come up with so far. So for the iPhone, that was a little convoluted, but at least it gets you there to the desired result. Once you do the triple click and have night shift enabled, now you actually have a good red filter on the phone, a good blue light filter on the phone. And that's going to really help, because devices, phones, iPads, and then to a lesser extent, computers and TVs are some of the biggest exacerbators for melatonin suppression. So are overhead lights that are bright and have the blue spectrum in them. So really minimizing those lights at night for melatonin production is going to be very, very important as a sleep hygiene suggestion. Then black out the bedroom. So again, bedrooms often have little LED lights. Some of them are blue, some of them are green on different devices. Sometimes there's lights outside that are coming in through the window. And so blackout curtains, little black electrical tape to go over LED lights, and getting it so that you cannot see your hand in front of your face when the lights are out in your room is going to be really, really helpful as well for getting sleep dialed in this and many other cases. So blackout the bedroom. Then we want to increase morning light within 30 minutes of waking for 30 minutes time exposed to bright light. Best way to do this is walk outside. That's going to get the maximal light exposure in the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the eyes to stimulate the cortisol awakening response and get that healthful circadian rhythm adjustment needed to have that maximal initial cortisol expression to feel energetic throughout the day, and then the maximal cortisol suppression, melatonin maximization through reduced light at night. Now, walk outside is best if unable to walk outside, sitting by a window with direct sun, and the direct is important, against the eyes for 30 minutes is acceptable for this purpose, but will not produce vitamin D. So through a window, you can get the cortisol awakening response activated. You can stimulate the suprachiasmatic nucleus, but you cannot produce vitamin D because the UV spectrum that produces vitamin D is filtered by the window. So if you want to get some vitamin D production and the cortisol awakening response, that walking 30 minutes in the morning with maybe some short sleeve shirt or shorts can help get both vitamin D and to also simultaneously be able to get the cortisol awakening response. Now, of course, you get maximal vitamin D between the hours of 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., but you'll make some during the summertime at least when you're going out in the morning for a walk. So that can be a good way to also get some exercise in. So lots of reasons why that morning walk would be really, really helpful. So those are some of the biggest sleep hygiene things: the light modulation, both less blue and bright lights at night, more bright light exposure in the morning is going to be optimal. If needed, you can get a 10,000 lux light box to stimulate the cortisol awakening response. So that's a last solution if the other two don't work, because the other two are preferable. But if need be, then a 10,000 lux or greater light box. And in some places, that's more needed than others. If there's a lot of cloudy days, then the light box may be a really good solution during especially certain seasons, like cloudy seasons in places like Portland or areas where the sun isn't out very many days. So that would be another thing to consider on the sleep hygiene side of things to get sleep dialed in, which is really important for not only energy, but also blood sugar regulation, because sleep and stress have big ties into blood sugar, and that's important. Now, on the stress front, daily meditation practice would be amazing if he were willing, able, and ready to do that. So that would be something to add in on the stress front. There's also decreased cardiovascular disease risk from meditation practice, increase in immune function. So there's quite a bit that could be helpful there on the meditation front. Okay, so this has been a lot on this case. I think this is a really good plan to bring potassium levels up. Could do that through diet or supplements or a combination of the two. Make sure magnesium status is also increased, which is already happening. Maybe adding hibiscus tea as an additional blood pressure help or aid. Plus the dietary front already seems to be helping, which is fantastic. Nitric oxide supplementation for both the blood pressure and erectile dysfunction. L-arginine starting at 3 grams, working up to 6, watching for diarrhea. If there is lysine concerns, adding L-lysine in as well can be fine. Glutathione, adding that in, 200 milligrams per day if it's acetyl or liposomal, 500 to 1,000 if it's oral reduced. And that's probably one of the big ones. So I'm going to add that into the overall supplementation here. I'm going to add in glutathione. And so that will be helpful as well there, 200 to 1,000 milligrams per day, depending on the form. All the sleep hygiene suggestions plus stress. And then the last thing I'll mention on this case is probably zinc is going to be helpful. Zinc can reduce dihydrotestosterone, which could be a byproduct of the testosterone injections. It can also increase testosterone, but it does it in a way that modulates the harmful impact potential of dihydrotestosterone. So zinc supplementation may be warranted in this case. 15 milligrams would be a good place to start. Could do up to 30. I wouldn't go any higher than 40 without good reason. That's the upper tolerable limit, at least for long-term dosing. And if dosing higher than 15 for a long period of time, I would consider copper supplementation at about a 1 to 10 ratio. So if doing 30 milligrams per day of zinc, maybe a 3 milligram, a 2 to 3 milligram dose of copper to combine with that. So we'll say zinc, and forms on zinc could be glycinate or L-methionine would be another form that would be fine on that, and we'll say but not oxide, and we'll say at 15 milligrams per day or 30 milligrams per day, but use 2 milligrams copper per day in that case, 2 to 3. And then other blood sugar things that I won't write down here because I don't know how necessary or helpful they would be, but there are, of course, herbal things like gymnema and bitter melon. There's things like vanadium and chromium. There's things like fiber and increasing fiber through either fiber supplements or seeds and ground seeds and other food sources of fiber can be important as well. So that's all outlined in the cardiometabolic module in great detail, but those are some just quick points and pointers and tips to think about on the dietary front. I know there's already good stuff happening on diet here, so I'm not going to spend a ton of time on that, but just that brief aside for you. So there we are on the erectile dysfunction and blood pressure and diabetes and fatigue and low testosterone case. So that should be interesting for you guys to get a lot of information about how to deal with those kinds of issues. So let's pull up the next in the questions that we have. So we had a question, 59-year-old female with chronic fatigue and severe brain fog. A lot of the blood sugar and cardiovascular markers are getting under control with current therapies, but there's still some, the chronic fatigue and the brain fog have not lifted yet. Recently did an HLA-DR genetic test for predisposition to mold toxicity, and she had the pattern that is the chronic fatigue and mold susceptible pattern. She also has SIBO and is doing a partial elemental diet currently. Epstein-Barr virus is possibly reactivated according to LabCorp test, and she's positive for HSV 1 and 2. No candida in the blood, no H. pylori, no Lyme according to LabCorp, and no common symptoms of Lyme. Quick aside, LabCorp is not the best Lyme test out there. I much prefer an Igenix Lyme test or a DNA Connections Lyme test or a Vibrant Wellness Lyme and co-infections test. So those would all be preferable, but no need to go there if we find things in other ways. But I will say that fatigue could be, and brain fog could be, symptoms of Lyme. So it's not off the table, but with the HLA-DR showing the chronic fatigue mold susceptible pattern, then we do want to look at that first. So here the thinking is, maybe that there's something missing, thinking about starting to treat the EBV with high-dose vitamin A, lorazepam, and L-lysine. What do we think? Should we get her tested for mold? Should we do more different testing on her besides the HLA-DR genetic? And what would we do to look at other, you know, the HSV treatment? What tests would we run next? So, on this one, we do like viral treatment and all the things that were mentioned, high dose vitamin A plus lorazepam plus L-lysine are all good interventions. And I would add, we'd add high dose mushrooms, in particular cordyceps has some good antiviral components to it. So 3 grams per day of cordyceps would be a good addition in this case. You could use other mushrooms like chaga or other things as well. You could use a beta-glucan supplement. There are a variety of things you can use. If you're going to use mushrooms, Primal Herbs is a reasonable brand of mushrooms that are grown on wood instead of grain. And so you can use Primal Herbs chaga. They have a straight chaga. They have an ATP energy supplement that has a pretty high dose of cordyceps in it. It also has a little bit of green tea extract and a couple other things that are focused on ATP and mitochondrial support, but that could be a reasonable one here as well. And then Virographis is a supplement by Zymogen that helps with viral. It has a lot of andrographis in it. So you could look at Virographis, you could look at medicinal mushrooms and or a beta-glucan product. And I think Zymogen has a glucan or some sort of mushroom extract product, which wouldn't be exactly the same as some of the antivirals in Cordyceps specifically, but it would have the immune modulating effect that we're looking for. So let me see if I'm clear. So that would be the Immunotics, and there's the Immunotics 250 or the Immunotics 500. And that is the 1.3/1.6 whole glucan particle. And so one cap at the 500 would be another thing to consider adding in of that. So if you wanted to if you wanted to stick with Zymogen and not introduce another company, that would be a great way to go, is the Immunotics together with Virographis and then the high dose vitamin A. On the vitamin A, I recommend the vitamin A that comes from fish, rather than a retinol palmitate. So that is not carried by Zymogen, but there is Protocol for Life Balance has a vitamin A that's 25,000 IU per cap. And that one is able to be, that one comes from, it comes from that one comes from fish. So it's less prone to toxicity. Oh, sorry, I also see a hand raised by Christina, so I want to just ask Christina, do you want to say anything more about your case or anything else? Do you want to discuss or chat in person here? If so, I will promote you here. Oh, no, okay. Never mind then. Okay, so on the vitamin A then, we of course want to monitor liver enzymes and let people know symptoms that can increase on higher dose vitamin A. So that's going to be things like so floaters in the eyes, migraines if a person has a tendency towards migraines or other headaches, increasing in frequency, light sensitivity, so feeling like, bright lights are hard, pain in the right side, right abdominal pain would be another potential symptom, and then running a CMP for liver enzymes and making sure liver enzymes aren't getting elevated. Now, depending on how big a dose of vitamin A, you don't have to be as cautious if you're doing one cap a day, but if you're doing more like four caps a day to get 100,000, then it would be good to monitor those liver enzymes. You can go as high as 500,000 per day for 3 days, and then go down to 200,000 per day for 3 days, and then go down to 100,000, but definitely want to let a person know all the symptoms and make sure there aren't any liver issues if you're going to do that kind of a high dose. I usually don't do that kind of a high dose unless there's just, a really stubborn viral infection. And what treats the EBV will also likely treat the HSV. There's a lot of commonalities in there. There's general antiviral impacts. So when you're doing the vitamin A and the lorazepam, I do it 3 scoops per day, or 1 scoop 3 times a day, or 1.5 scoops twice a day. So that would be a good starting dose there. Vitamin A, you know, most cases I just start with 4 caps per day of the 25,000 IU from fish, which would be 100,000 IU per day. And then L-lysine would be in the 3 gram to 6 gram per day, and 3 would be a good starting place for that. So that would be good. And then adding the mushrooms or the immunotics and the virographis for additional viral support. And then in terms of the Lyme testing, that would be on the back burner to do a better Lyme test to see if that is an issue. But for mold, we'd want to run a TGF beta 1, a transcription growth factor beta 1 right away. If greater than 2300, then we want to do a Hertzmead test on the home and the office place, if there's a lot of time spent at the office place, and start on binder treatment for reducing the toxic burden in the body. And that could be colostyramine or Welchol if going the prescription route, if going the supplement route, a combination of charcoal or chitosan and or chlorella and or a glucomannan or propylmannan, which could be Zymogen's optifibrillin or PGX granules, are both options there. And then the activated charcoal, I like the coconut-based charcoal, which is Protocol for Life Balance or Enzymedica carry coconut-based charcoals. And then GI Detox is a mix between charcoal and clay. That is a good one by Biobotanical. And there's chitosan, the microchitosan by Allergy Research Group. So those are all good options on binders for the natural side on mold treatment. Of TGF beta 1 through LabCorp is elevated above 2300 to help get that down below 2300, and then you want to do a retest on that. If the Hertzmead score is greater than 10 on any of the locations where the person spends a lot of time, then that's a more complicated conversation. But remediating and or essential oil purging and or getting out or moving are all good options in that case. But we'll want to address getting out of exposure or reducing exposure. So that will be something to do on if the Hertzmead test comes elevated. Mycometrics is a company that does Hertzmead testing. The person can order it directly, or you can carry it in your office. We do enough of it to carry it in our office, but it is a direct-to-consumer lab company, so you are able to, if it's simpler for you or for your office, you are able to refer people to get from Mycometrics directly that Hertzmead test or an ERMI test. ERMI is more expensive and gives more options, and you can pull Hertzmead score from ERMI. It shows more molds than Hertzmead shows. Hertzmead shows the main ones, and it's less expensive. It's $150 cost. So $150 is the cost for anyone who orders direct from Mycometrics. So that's something to consider. So that would be a big one to do. You could also do a urine mycotoxin through Vibrant Wellness if you wanted to, as another option aside from the TGF beta 1, to see about toxin, mycotoxin in the urine. If you do the urine mycotoxin test, I would be sure to do either a far infrared sauna, intense exercise, whole body vibration or a deep tissue massage prior to the urination. You could do that day before, like the evening before, and then take first morning urine would be an option. So I would make sure to get some of that, something to get out of tissue the toxin if you're going to go that route. So those are considerations as far as the next test. And then, yes, also consider a Marcon's nasal swab to look for multiple antibiotic-resistant coagulative-negative staph. And if present, that would be something to treat. And then if the chronic fatigue has not resolved after that treatment, I would test for melanocyte-stimulating hormone, or MSH. And if it's under 30, then I would do some treatment for Marcon's, make sure Marcon's gets cleared, add some glycine at 3 grams per day, and then if needed, do VIP nasal spray to get that MSH back up. And that could be a missing link in terms of the energy and the chronic fatigue. Then the other thing I would add into the LabCorp order is antiparietal antibodies. It's very inexpensive. Sometimes insurance covers it. If insurance does not cover it, then it's only if you get an account, if you're able to get an account with professional co-op. If you're a provider who can do blood testing, then you can get an account with professional co-op. And with professional co-op, you can do $35, I think, is your practitioner cost for antiparietal cell antibodies, and then you can choose whether you pass along cost or upcharge to patients. There's a $7 draw fee as well if it gets drawn at LabCorp. And then you could also order the TGF-beta one there as well. I believe your cost would be about $99 at this point in time for TGF-beta one. And again, you can choose whether to upcharge or pass along cost. And so you could get TGF-beta-1 in antiparietal cell antibodies. You could also get melanocyte-stimulating hormone if you wanted to, or you could wait until after you've gotten TGF-beta-1 to below 2300 and after Marcon's is cleared, and then test MSH and see where that's at. And my inclination would be to wait on MSH. If you do the urine mycotoxin, I recommend Vibrant Wellness on that. So Vibrant Wellness is the lab for the urine mycotoxin, and that is a great test to do as well. So Vibrant Wellness, most practitioner types should be able to make an account with them, including nutritionists, so you guys should be able to make an account there. You also, if you can't get an account with LabCorp or Professional Co-op, Life Extension has a blood panel that includes TGF-beta-1, a panel that includes a lot of other stuff. Some of that stuff might be useful, some might not be useful. And it's fairly pricey, but it is an option. And I believe that with a nutrition license, or, you know, a lot of license types should be able to get an account with Life Extension. So that is an option to be able to do as well if you need it. So those would be the good options there on the mycotoxin testing or inflammatory marker like TGF-beta-1 testing to be able to do on the mold front there. And then if the antiparietal cell antibodies come back positive, we've covered this in another Q&A, but I'll cover it again here since there was that question. So Antiparietal cell antibodies, if they're above 15, I like to treat. If they're above 20, for sure treatment is warranted. And the best treatment is either methylcobalamin or hydroxycobalamin injections. I like 10 milligrams, and you can get 10 milligram per milliliter. We order from Custom Rx for our injectable, and that would be 10 milligram injections IM and once per week for 12 weeks, and then retest antiparietal cell antibodies. If below 15, I'd go to once every other week for 12 weeks, retest. If still below 15, I go to once a month and see if you can maintain it at once a month. If a person doesn't want to keep going on injections, I would give a 10,000 microgram sublingual once per day, or two 5,000 microgram sublinguals once per day. So 10,000 micrograms is 10 milligrams, and it's as a sublingual, but it's daily because the absorption won't be quite as good. And then I would still retest after a few months to make sure it's staying in balance there. I would also address H. pylori if present and SIBO if present as well, to make sure that there aren't exacerbating factors. And I'd also look at thyroid, because 20 to 40% of people with parietal cell antibodies have low or 20%, 20 to 40% of low thyroid cases have antiparietal cell antibodies. So if there are antiparietal cell antibodies, I would be, you know, looking for hypothyroid if you haven't already. I imagine you have already, given that it looks like you did some blood sugar and metabolic marker testing, and I imagine thyroid was a part of that as well. So that would be treatment there. Viral treatment and some additional testing on mold, and then some examples of some of the kinds of things we would do for testing on mold. Okay, we probably have time for one more question. If any of you on live have a question, please type it in right away so we can be sure to get to it. And then also look here at the next question docked here. Okay, we have a question on for elemental diet. If we're doing elemental, either fully or semi-elemental diet as a SIBO treatment, is diarrhea normal? And yes, absolutely. So when we're doing elemental diet or semi-elemental diet, it is a liquid diet. It has zero fiber in it. We are intentionally bypassing the digestive process, and so it is completely normal to have liquid stool or diarrhea during that period, even if diarrhea is something that we're treating. Because SIBO is causing diarrhea, we are eradicating SIBO with the elemental or the semi-elemental diet, and it's normal to have some diarrhea or liquid stool during, and even for a few days after the end. Within 7 days or fewer after elemental diet has ended, we normally do see a reduction in diarrhea. Now, you can, if you're with elemental or semi-elemental, if you're adding some extra MCT oil or coconut oil, and if you're doing a percentage that's higher on that, you can reduce that percentage some, because in some cases that can trigger a little bit of a worsening diarrhea. But it's normal. Prep people on that. I prep people on that. Actually, today I prescribed elemental diet, and I said, it's a liquid diet. You may have liquidy stools during the diet, and for a few days after the diet, that's totally normal. Within 7 days or less of stopping the diet and returning to a regular healthy diet, we should see stools normalize and regulate. So that's what I let her know for the elemental diet today. And so now she's prepped. We're not going to get that, you know, call where a person is saying, hey, I'm having some diarrhea here. So good to prep people on that. Totally normal that that's happening. Let people know that is not only acceptable, but it's the norm for what happens during elemental diet. We are still killing off SIBO. We do expect it to re-regulate after going back onto foods. Sometimes when going back onto foods, if it's still an issue after a couple of days, adding in some chia seeds can help. And doing a couple of tablespoons of chia seed soaked in water for overnight, and then drinking that water down and having quite a lot of water. So maybe 12 ounces or so of water in the 2 tablespoons of chia seeds soaked overnight in the fridge, and then drink it down in the morning. That can be a great, it's good to stir that a couple times. Like if you started soaking an hour before bed, stir it right before bed, stir it in the morning, and then, you know, let it warm up a little bit out of the fridge, and then drink it down. So that can help with reforming the stool after the elemental diet if you need to help with that stool reformation. Okay. We've gone over a lot today, so hope that you've enjoyed this case. It is always these cases that we've covered today and the questions. It's wonderful to be getting so many great questions from you, so please keep submitting questions. Remember to go into the member area, and from the main courses page, there's the submit case button. And you also, when you go to the MMCP page or the MMCP overview, there's also a submit case there. So please do use that submit case button to submit cases or questions. You can submit questions that aren't cases there as well. And please do submit those. Also, at the bottom of the case submission, there's a link to labs.mindfulness-medicine.com, and that is where you can upload labs that go with cases. Please remove identifying info from the labs so that we can show those labs without revealing patient info. You can either edit PDF, or you can, if you have a printout, you can cover it up, or you can, you know, Sharpie it or cover it up with a sticky note or something and then scan it. And you know, or do a whiteout on it, or you can use a PDF editing software like Adobe Acrobat. If you have the professional version, is very good at editing. It's very simple. If you don't have that, PDFescape.com is another way to edit online that some people have reported some success with. So please do remove that identifying info when you submit those labs so that we can use them in these webinars without revealing any patient info. So thank you so much for your attention, your questions, and I look forward to doing the next one, or Dr. Diane, I'm not sure which one of us, but we look forward to helping to address your questions. Keep them coming, and have a wonderful, healthy, and happy evening and weekend and week, and we'll talk to you soon. Take good care.